This week on Out Now with Aaron and Abe, we're talking The Bike Riders. Vroom, 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 vroom.
Wait a minute, I forgot my introduction.
We are now recording, and this is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and Abe is unfortunately not here. He's out on assignment this week, but Out Now is a film podcast where Abe and I discuss new movies weekly. We dig into film, mostly spoiler-free review, the occasional commentary track, or some other film movie topic. This is episode 582, and this week we're talking The Bike Riders, the newest film from director Jeff Nichols. And joining me to discuss The Bike Riders, we have writer for JoeBlow.com and star of the horror short, The Foot of the Bed, it's Jimmy O.
Yes, good to be back, man. It's been a while.
Also joining us, co-host of the Linoleum Knife Podcast and author of the book Hollywood Pride, it's Alonzo Duralde.
Hello.
Great to have both of you guys here. I know it's been a minute for both of you, but very happy to have you both on here. Excited to have both of you on here. Looking forward
Thanks for having us.
For sure.
Yeah.
Jimmy, always a pleasure to have you on here. It's just nice to see it.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. It's I've had an interesting year.
So it's nice to get you back on the podcasting track with us over here.
Feels good, man.
And Alonzo, this is officially your sophomore episode.
Yes,
you've found your way back to the realm of Out Now there today, and I'm very happy about that. And you have a new book out.
I do. It's called Hollywood Pride. It is out from TCM and Running Press, and it is a history of queer Hollywood on screen and off.
What better way to celebrate Pride Month than talk about Jeff Nichols, The Bike Riders, and then eventually have a discussion about your new book, which we will do after our review for the movie. Alonzo and I are going to talk about his book, so stay tuned for that. Along with everything
this
else.
Might be the most heterosexual film about motorcyclists ever made.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to all that and more, but first, let's get to the show notes. First up, commentary tracks. We do a commentary every month on this podcast, which is always a lot of fun. And for our summer lineup of commentaries, we are going global. We are doing international features. So we just did our commentary for Run Lola Run for its 25th anniversary, which you can find now on iTunes and Spotify, and every good fine podcast. And we have more fun ones coming up in the next coming months. We're going to do Chungking Express in July. And I believe Kiki's Delivery Services are planned for August. So stay tuned for some fun commentaries. Speaking of all these bonus shows that we have, all of those you can find, as I mentioned, on iTunes and Spotify, as well as all the episodes of this show. And if you go onto those sites, you can give us a rating or review, which would be great. It would help pop us up the old iTunes charts. If you give us a star rating and a review, that'd be wonderful. So thank you.
Give them 5 stars, people.
Five. Yes, mm-hmm.
Yes, please.
The preferable number of
three
stars.
Or four. Five.
If there's a 4, I just want to see the feedback of what lost us that star.
Can we better serve you?
Exactly. What else? Of course, the 12th annual Summer Movie Gamble. So you guys are not specifically involved in this, but Abe and I, along with many other frequent guests of the show, we try to predict every year the top 10 highest grossing films at the domestic box office, which usually goes along poorly, but we do our best anyway. We are in the heat of this right now because we're at the end of June. There's just been a lot of movies that have come out, and a lot of them have not done as well as some of us might have thought. That said, some of us predicted Inside Out 2 would be the number one film of the summer, and right now it is doing a tremendous job of proving me to be right because it made another $100 million this weekend at the box office. So the Pixar swing back around into the positive is in full effect here. That made another 100. Bad Boys made another 18, which is quite good for Bad Boys. And it's third week. And as far as anything else that kind of matters to this, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is still making some money. If is still making some money. We'll see where things go. It was a quieter week in terms of new releases that were making heaps of money. But we got some July 4th action coming along pretty soon that'll determine even more about this very intense contest that many of us are involved in. All right. Let's get some show notes out of the way. Let's move on. Let's get to some Out Now quickies. Each week at Out Now, we have one main movie of the week that we talk about. Well, we always have other movies that we see during the week. That's always having to call it Out Now quickies. That's the slowest I've ever said that. make sure we're all on the same page here. Alonzo, I want to start with you. What movies have you seen recently?
I will give you a new one and an old one. Right. My new one is Thelma, which okay. I kept hearing about for ages. And it's been, when it was making the festival rounds, people kept saying how wonderful it was. And it turns out they were right. It is a delight. June Squibb is a great comic lead. This is the first time that this 90-plus-year-old actress has gotten to be number one on the call sheet. And she is wringing every drop of enjoyment out of it. It's a really charming kind of action question mark comedy. Yeah. Richard Roundtree in his final role. Great, always great supporting performance from Parker Posey. But just really charming, really funny. You know, if you're looking for a movie to take your parents or grandparents to, this should be top of the list, but you don't have to. Just date night, any reason. If you're going to the movies, go see Thelma. You don't have to go with a senior citizen and you will still enjoy it.
It's very enjoyable. And I want to shout out, like, obviously June Squibb is like, she's very fun at it. It's just nice to see Richard Roundtree one last time, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't realize, I couldn't remember if I remember that he was in it, but I didn't realize he was going to have like such a major role in it. So that was nice to see him as like a buddy duo essentially for this film.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. No. So they're terrific together and you know, RIP Mr. Roundtree. And then my older film for the week. So one of the podcasts I do, Breakfast All Day, with Christy Lemire, we do a monthly thing for our Patreon members called, Off the Menu, where we'll pick out a handful of films hewing to a certain theme or person and have them pick one that we'll review and do exclusively for our Patreon members. So when Roger Corman passed away, we did a choice of 5 or 6 Corman directed titles, and our subscribers picked Mask of the Red Death, which I had never seen. And it's great. It is one of the Poe adaptations with Vincent Price, but like wonderful Richard Beaumont script. Nicholas Rogue shot it. The color is brilliantly lurid. You can see like the Jalo guys taking frantic notes on this movie. They had, and I think because they borrowed a bunch of castle sets left over from Beckett, it probably like looks a lot better than a lot of the AIP movies of the early 60s of those Corman quickies. Yeah, very cool, very atmospheric, you know, and very much still relevant, you know, about this sort of decadent aristocrat who thinks that he can put a wall up between himself and a plague and discovers that maybe not.
Well, very cool. Jimmy and I in October, along with our friend of the show, Brandon Peters, and Ape, of course, we like to do a lot of these horror themed bonus episodes. We haven't really done like a Hammer set or like in that kind of realm in the years we've been doing that, but that would... Even is Master, is that, would that be considered a Hammer? Or is that just like,
no? This is AIP, which is the Arkoff and Nicholson's company.
So yeah, even American in that kind movie. Of like realm of like the kind of like 50s, 60s, leaning into 70s kind of like big Technicolor horror stuff, that'd be a fun thing to explore for us in the future for sure.
Check it out, I think you'll enjoy it. And it is so, in some ways, it is so 60s. Like the female lead is played by Jane Asher, who was like famous for having dated Paul McCartney for a while. And, you know, like one of the villains is played by Patrick McGee, who's in A Clockwork Orange. You would recognize him. He's the guy who takes in Alex at the end of the movie and then tortures him. But anyway, it's just a delight to look at. And I loved reading on the wiki page later that it wasn't a giant hit for them. And Arkoff claimed the problem is it was too arty farty. But I would say the arty fartiness has aged well.
All right. Well, Jimmy, what have you been watching recently?
Well, not much. I had a couple of things like the embargo type thing, but I did see Thelma. I absolutely love Thelma. That was amazing. I gotta give props to Frank. The trio. There's her. Yeah. What a delightful performance from all three of those actors, right?
Mm-hmm.
Definitely, and like little sprinkle of Nicole Byer and you know Clark Gregg in there too for good measure.
Very entertaining. Very. That's about it though. I've been a little bit busy with other stuff. Like,
fair enough. I've seen a few things, mainly horror, it looks like, actually. I saw The Exorcism, the latest Russell Crowe exorcist-themed movie. It's its own subgenre now, I guess. I will say this. The ending doesn't work. However, the build of the movie involves him playing this struggling actor who has gotten this job to be in a Exorcist type remake of some movie. It's not exactly disclosed. That said, the film's directed by Joshua Miller, the son of Jason Miller.
Yes.
And it's produced by Kevin Williamson. And it feels like a Scream type movie, but played completely straight. There's no like humor to it, but it does have a sense of they know what movie they're doing. And even, and early on there's camera work that kind of reflects that it's in on like what atmosphere it's after. I wish it was able to hold on that to that vibe throughout the movie. But I have a mild appreciation for it, because I do think Crow is doing the work here for a movie he filmed 5 years ago, apparently. Wow. And it had more interesting stuff in it than I expected. Would I rather see Pope's Exorcist 2 with him being back on that moped? Of course I would. Get him back on that moped immediately. But
I feel like if Jason Miller's son is making a movie about an actor making an exorcism movie and losing it, like this goes right next to Bratz in the maybe you should have worked this out in therapy cinema rather than devote an entire feature film to it.
It's fair. That's a fair statement. He wrote the Final Girls, a film that I really that was my main reason I wanted to see the movie. I was like, all right, let's see what he's going to do as a director. The problem, it plays it so straight. There's no humor here. Like, it doesn't have a lot to like make me come back to and be like, oh, let me see it again to see if I find new things. It's like, no, it presents everything on its head. But there's like a good like third, almost two thirds that I like appreciated more than I expected. So I'm not going to like write it off completely. That's where I'm at with that movie. Speaking of horror, I also saw Humanist Vampire Seeking Consenting Suicidal Person. My pick for the best title of the year so far.
I mean, you know, it's no codependent space lesbian space alien seek same, but it's up there.
this is a French film, obviously. It's a French film. It's about a family of vampires and the youngest daughter in the family. She is very fittingly going along with the Inside Out 2 and Tiger Stripes for that matter. She's basically budding as a vampire, but her fangs haven't come in yet. And the film works as a kind of metaphor for like going through adolescence or what have you, and like becoming of age to be the vampire that her parents and her older sister are. During this coming of age journey, she meets a boy who has suicidal thoughts, and perhaps they can get together and both solve each other's problems. Things ensue from there. I enjoyed this movie. It's a comedy, ostensibly. It has a humorous streak running through it. I enjoyed what it was after. It's not like one of my favorites of the year so far, but I enjoy like going in based on like the fact that I just really liked what the title gave me. It's like, okay, this movie has some goods. I enjoyed what it was going for overall. That's that one.
Is that a theatrical or is it going to streaming?
It's from Drafthouse. I think it's like has a very limited theatrical release, and then like we'll go probably like straight to digital, like either at the same time or shortly after.
Gotcha.
I want to mention this other one. I will. Reverse the Curse. This is David Duchovny's new feature. He's directed the film based on his own book, where he plays a dad with like cancer. I believe it's just cancer. Like they don't specify too much. It's one of those like dad's dying diseases. His son, played by Logan Marshall Green, speaking of Tom Hardy, is
the Tom Hardy you get when you can't get Tom Hardy.
Yeah, it's set in like the late 70s. He's like a hippie kind of character. He and his dad are estranged. They come back together so he can like deal with him. Stephanie Beatrice plays like a death consultant because that's the job. The dad is a big Red Sox fan. His health seems to be getting better anytime the Red Sox are doing good. So Logan Marshall Green concocts a scheme for his friends and Beatrice to kind of stage that the Red Sox are doing better than they actually are. Ideally to get his dad out of bed and get him working and doing, you know, being better again. It's a pretty standard, like father son drama about the two reconciling their differences and getting back together. Duchovny is very good in this movie. He plays up his kind of sardonic side, but he's also like grouchy dad, so like it has a little bit going on there. Logan Marshall Green, I am so hit or miss on. Sometimes I think he's like effective for the role. Other times I think he's like, yeah, it just feels like we couldn't get Tom Hardy. Like that's not always the best. Here he has to play a hippie where he has like super long hair and like mutton chops for like a majority of the movie, and it's like, all right, it just looks like a big wig and mutton chops that you're wearing, yeah, and not just looking like Logan Marshall Green. So I'm a little mixed. I think the company kind of puts it over the top for me, but it is a fairly like model and type film as far as what it's after. But it's nice seeing the company just like deliver in the way he is. So can't complain too much. I didn't dislike my time watching it. And that's it. That's enough cookies. DM.
I will add, I did see the exorcism and I forgot. So
yeah. That's just strong opinions. Yeah.
And that's your review.
All right. Well, let's move on. Let's get to our main review now. Let's get to The Bike Riders.
I'm thinking of starting a riding club.
Why? All those clubs do is sit around talking about motorcycles.
That's what we do.
You don't belong nowhere else, so we belong together.
If you're the man in charge,
I'm Johnny. We're the Vandals.
I'm Ben. I like you guys.
Your boyfriends are getting into trouble.
What the hell were you thinking back there?
Nothing. I saw you scoring off of them guys. What do I need to think for?
Yeah, you and me, kid.
That should have been some of the trailer for The Bike Riders. Director Jeff Nichols' previous feature was 2016's Loving. Based on attempts to reboot Alien Nation and possibly direct a prequel to A Quiet Place, more on that next week, we've had to wait a little while to get a new feature from the celebrated director. With that said, Nichols has had some version of The Bike Riders in his mind going back over 10 years at this point. Inspired by the photo book by Danny Lyon, the film tells the story of the fictional motorcycle gang The Vandals, headed by Tom Hardy's Johnny. Set in 60s Chicago, one of its newest recruits is Austin Butler's Benny, a hothead in love with his bike and being a part of this gang. The story unfolds thanks to narration by Jodie Comer's Kathy, who fell for Benny and has to navigate being a part of the world that would dabble with crime and create conflict based on gang loyalties. Jimmy, I want to start with you. Are you a Jeff Nichols fan in general? And what do you think of Bike Riders?
Absolutely. I'm a huge Jeff Nichols fan. I think he's over the years, he's become a filmmaker just that, I don't know. I've gotten to a point where film criticism is an interesting thing, because oftentimes if you just don't connect with an artist, no matter how good they are, you're not going to like their work. Jeff's work is always connected. I love Loving. I love, one of my favorites was Midnight Special. So weirdly enough, I wasn't as, even though, yes, it's shocking. Everyone knows I live on Montgomery. Everyone knows I'm now a Jeff Nichols fan. I was the idea of those guys together excited me, but I didn't love the trip immediately. I was like, really? I don't know. Because I grew up like loving Easy Ride. I love Sons of Anarchy. I loved all stuff. That was the 20-year-old me. That's what I yeah, that'd be cool to go, you know, get on Harley and stuff like that. I never did, but this movie spoke to me in ways I had not expected. I just got it. It just felt right to me. Like the soundtrack, it reminded me a lot of Goodfellas, and that's,
I can see that. Okay,
yeah, Goodfellas maybe without so much of the a little less killing, still killing, but you know, a little less. But I just think it's a smart movie. I think it's a feel good movie. I love the three performances. I love all the performances. But I'm an unabashed fan of The Bike Riders. I just think it's a beautiful, cool little film. I'm not talking like epic, grand, and but I do think it around the Academy Award time, it should be considered, at least.
All right. Alonzo, same question. Are you a Jeff Nichols fan in general? And what did you think of this film?
I'm admittedly kind of hit and miss with him, and I haven't seen all of his films. Like, I still haven't seen Take Shelter, which I need to, or the very first one, which I know was didn't get a ton of release. But, like, I like Mud a lot, and I think there are things in Loving that are effective. Not a big fan of Midnight Special. So I walked into this one not really knowing how it was going to be, and I found myself really I think the film really kind of draws you into this world, and it really sort of creates this specific time and place and setting and these people. But I was completely enthralled with it while I was watching it. And I didn't really realize until later, he's not doing this in a way that that I think a lot of filmmakers would sort of traditionally do. You don't get a ton of backstory on most of the characters. Like, they are men who don't talk a lot about themselves, and they're men who live very much in the moment, and that's reflected in the way they're presented in the film. And so, you know, like, you have the trope of, you know, Mike Faced is playing Danny Lyon, you know, is taking the pictures, doing the interviews, mostly doing the interviews with Jodie Comer's character. And I found her to be such a fascinating outsider insider. Like, she has this really compelling way of telling the story where she seems incredulous about it half the time, but she's very much reporting on how this world works and what's set up. And so even if we don't really get to know a lot about where does Benny come from, what drives him, what's he about, Austin Butler is such a movie star, and Nichols shoots him like such a movie star.
Sure does.
That, like, we know why Kathy fell in love with him. You know, even if this character is very underwritten in the traditional sense, the images tell us what we need to know. And so I've been sort of describing this movie as more of a mood than a plot, because it really is about just sort of feeling what this weird sense of camaraderie is, and even if, like, you know, you don't necessarily come up with this sort of big sweeping romantic sense of, like, oh, wasn't this an amazing period, you see what happens later, and that sort of next phase of biker gang is so grim, with the heroin and the, like, literally becoming basically an organized crime cartel, that it sort of retroactively gives kind of a rosy innocence to these guys just drinking a bunch of beer and, you know, bashing each other's head in out in a field somewhere. So yeah, it worked for me ultimately, but it surprised me later to realize how much I didn't get from this movie that I think I would have expected to get, but that it was okay, that what I did get told me enough.
Yeah, agreed.
I feel like I had a similar reaction, and I'm a big Jeff Nichols fan. I really Take Shelter, I think, is a fantastic film, and Michael Shannon gives one of my favorite performances of that decade in that movie. And then his work in general, I've always been a fan of. I really like this first film, Shotgun Stories. I like Special and Loving and Mud. This one, if I feel like this is lesser than some of his other ones, it's only because I just like the other ones more. But I still walked away liking this movie overall. I can agree with you, Alonzo, that the mood is really a big part of, like, what makes it work overall. It's less about telling you the interiority that's going on with, like, all these characters, and I think that works for some better than others. Like, Tom Hardy, he's very good in this movie, and he does a lot without having to do a lot, if you know what I mean. He like, there's scenes of him just kind of staring at a TV or barely talking to his wife or looking like he's looking amidst in a restaurant, but, like, I feel like I get what he's after. I get what his character's all about. And that works. That replaces my need to have the more traditional, like, let's unfold who this person is or whatnot, because I feel like I get it from some of these instances with him. Butler, I think in the first half, I was really enjoying, because, yes, he's presented like this movie star character. He has a clear charisma about him that works for Jodie Comer. One of my favorite scenes is Jodie Comer meeting Benny, where she goes into this biker bar, and her immediate reaction is, I want to get out of here, I want to leave. And then she's like, I don't really, like, you see her stop wanting to leave, but she's still, like, saying that she does. It's very fun, and it's all because she's just looking at Austin Butler. She, like, can't, like, take away. So, like, that's, and there's more of Butler, obviously, but, like, in that first half, I really enjoyed that. The second half, I'm not saying I suddenly started disliking him, but it was more, I realized I wasn't going to get more than what the film was showing me about him. And between that and between scenes of him and Hardy together, where I think Hardy very clearly shows that he's a more experienced actor, it just made me think there's three main characters here. Two of them, I think, are really delivering just 100% all across the board. And I think that's Hardy and Comer. Or Butler, I think, yeah, I can see room for like future roles where he's going to like excel even more. It even like, because this was made, I think, around the same time as Elvis, if I'm not mistaken, right? Like, it was,
it's before been Elvis, around, I believe.
Before Elvis even came out, I know that. So, like, there's, like, because I think, like, Butler in Dune, for example, I think he's tremendous in that movie. He has limited time in it, and he only has so much to do. But I feel like he's harnessed more of what that thing is versus here, where I think he's very good, but, like, comes up a little short when I'm matching him against something like Hardy. And that's neither here nor there. He's good at the movie. The movie as a whole, I like the world we are in. I like these the various character actors that we have. Michael Shannon pops up, as he usually does in Jeff Nichols films, and he has a wonderful little bit where he talks about being rejected from Vietnam that I think gave you just a great understanding of like who this guy is and why he's in this group. There's things like that scattered throughout the movie that I think really work well.
They've cast a lot of really good faces. Like so many of the supporting characters don't have a ton of screen time or dialogue to make an impression. Mm-hmm. So you cast Emery Cohen, you cast Boyd Holbrook, you cast these really like, you know, memorable faces, you know, Norman Reedus, obviously. And I think that
Norman Reedus, who I feel like he just like, can I just be in this? Like, I feel like that's the vibe.
They didn't hire him. He showed up. That's the vibe.
I got my own jacket.
Look what it did to my teeth, you know.
Damon Harriman, I think, is also very good here. Has, like, yes. Tom Hardy's number two. I think he is one of the best, like, I get this guy, I get completely. Like, I understand what this guy's about.
Benjamin Cross of... Benjamin. Fancy. Benjamin Cross of Elmwood Park was arrested and charged with 18 traffic violations, but not before reportedly running through 7 stoplights, hitting speeds over 85 miles an hour in 2 20-mile-an-hour school zones, and causing damage to 4 municipal vehicles as a result of the pursuit. Cross is free on the $2,500 bond and will stand trial in Park Ridge Traffic Court on December 9th.
How many stoplights did you win?
I said 7, so.
So what?
So I guess that's the number. But it felt like more.
If we're going to get, like, quibbly about screenplay, like, mechanics, I will say there is the movie is structured in a way where everything that we know is something that is told to Danny Lyon or that he witnesses firsthand, except for this a younger character who's not in the gang who becomes increasingly important as the film goes on. And he's the one character that we actually do get some backstory on, but it's like, from whom? Because Danny Lyon never meets this guy. He never talks to anybody who knows him. So that, and again, this is nitpicking and it didn't bother me, but it is a thing that I thought about later, just in terms of like puzzling out how the story is told. It's like, how does this guy enter into the movie when there's no conduit for him the way there is for everything else?
It's the kind of thing where the film's not going out of its way to explain its narrative, its framing structure. Yeah. It's just like, it's letting you accept the fact. It's like, and now we're taking a break from that to focus on this other thing here.
Meanwhile, at omniscient narrator,
But I think what you said, I think what you said about mood was so right on. I'm going to give my guy, Chris Bumbry, a little credit here. He wrote in his review, it was like if James Dean and Marlon Brando made a movie. That's kind of what it feels like. I think that's what a lot of people like about it. It's just so, it just feels like a mood. It feels like a time, you know, in it's such a really cool way.
It certainly hasn't, it literally calls out the wild one in the movie, which is another area where I get what Hardy's character is, because he's just watching the wild one. He's like, I want to emulate that thing.
Yeah, he's a guy doing Brando. Yeah.
And it's already Hardy, so it's like, that feels kind of meta. and then you have Butler, who also seems to have his own way of channeling stuff. So like, you put two Brandos together, it's like, okay, that's it's a lot.
Yeah,
but I do like that the film in this era of motorcycle outlaw gangdom. I like that Hardy's character, you get that, like, he doesn't really have much beyond, I just want to be cool like this guy. Like, that seems to be his modus operandi, which is interesting to me. It's not really as involved as any, as most other people that might be here.
You just reminded me of a very early Saturday Night Live sketch. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in Deliverance, there's that song Dueling Banjos. Mm-hmm. So John Belushi and Peter Boyle did Dueling Brandos.
Oh, so, I like, remember.
And you hear the banjo, dum-dum-dum-dum, and then one of them be like, you know, I could have been a contender. You know, like, they do back and forth different Brando lines from different movies while dressed as the character from The Wild One. Look it up on YouTube. It's a great one. It's very funny. It's very funny. This movie is also Dueling Brandos. Yeah.
Jimmy, I mean, you've expressed that you're just a huge fan of it. Any other aspects that, like, you just really glommed onto as far as, like, what set this apart?
Well, you know, I felt like it was a movie kind of out of its time in a way that, you know, I'm a huge lover of 70s cinema. I mean, that's just something that really appeals to me. And I remember movies like that really inspired me as a, when growing up, like The Last Picture Show. These really simple kind of tales that just are about something that happens in these people's lives. And they're well written, they're well performed, and there's a simplicity. Easy Rider, even, it's just, it's so great. It's such a great, it's a great feel. So I think that's bad. The soundtrack really kicks ass. I love the soundtrack.
And it's
the needle drops are great, and I am a big fan of David Wingo, who has done most of Nichols's movies, and I think, like, on a craft level, like, the reason that they're able to create this atmosphere that is, I think, so essential, like, you've got, you know, the same guy has been his DP the whole time. Mm-hmm. His editor, I believe this is the fourth film that she's worked with Nichols on, and I think for Wingo, his composer, it's like his fifth, you know. So, like, they there's clearly an understanding of how they work together, which I think is even more essential in a movie like this that isn't relying upon the words and isn't relying upon the plot as such, but it is about, like, this immersion into a time and a place and a specific sort of, you know, community.
That's fair. And that makes it feel the most like Mud, for example, as far as Nichols films go, where it's less about having this kind of direct plot and more of, let's find our way into this world through certain characters, meet different people, get an idea of the texture of all this stuff. And that's where the Bike Riders, I think, shines the best, where you're just kind of, like, with it with these guys. Like, I'm personally not, like, a motorcycle guy. I'm not a Harley guy by any means. But just looking at these shots of these guys on these bikes, or just seeing the bikes, or just seeing them at these social club gatherings, what do they call them? Like, there's stuff there that's like, I like being in this setting. I like this world. I'm enjoying the time here. I like seeing Johnny do next to nothing and get people's attention from that, and nearly get into brawls because of it. And then brawls do break out for other reasons. Like, there's a confidence there that I can appreciate. And yeah, Jimmy, that does bring to mind something like a Goodfellas, where you're in this world.
Yeah.
And it has the same kind of arc too, right? You see the good times for a group that mildly participates in crime versus the bad times when they're even more heavily involved in the crimes and the crimes getting worse and what have you.
Nichols, and I read an interview with him where he said that Goodfellas was absolutely an inspiration. I think that it's tracks. Also, like, it kind of falls into the larger sort of, like, those 1960s death of American innocence narratives that people love so much, you know. Weirdly, like, I think Platoon kind of falls in that category, although in that movie, the pot smokers are chill and the beer drinkers are, like, the violent, you know, ones. And here it sort of flips it where it's like, yeah, when it's just a bunch of guys drinking beer, it's like, you know, yeah, they'd beat each other up or whatever, but it was fine. But then once the Vietnam vets and their weed and their heroin start coming in, it's all over.
Yeah.
Cue jump into the fire, you know.
the separation with some of that is that obviously this is a movie made in 2024, so it can have a little more introspection as far as what these relationships are and what else it has to offer. It's not the 70s, so it doesn't need to be like, let's tell a story about America so much anymore. Because, like, We've seen people do that. What's Nichols going to offer instead? Here, in addition to just presenting that world, getting you back to be familiar with something you, frankly, you just don't see very much, because I was wondering this a lot, the kind of the outlaw motorcycle gang genre, aside from like Sons of Anarchy and its spinoff, like that's not really a genre anymore, right? There's not really biker movies these days.
No.
And I'm impressed that the movie made as much as it did this weekend. Good for it. But it's like, I guess people wanted to see this thing. It's just not a thing. But
I think it'll do well, too. I think that it will do well, really well with word of mouth.
For a focus feature like this, it's doing about as well as it's doing better than I would expect a film like this in today's economy to kind of do.
Regardless of what
can we go after, what it does present to us, along with the, you know, the texture and everything, is a love triangle. I mean, that's largely what it boils down to in this film, right? We have three leads. Now, a love triangle presented in a way that's not the conventional, like, which one's going to fall in love with who. But in terms of Benny or Johnny and Kathy are both, they have Benny, like, both in their sights for different reasons. And even Benny has his own way of presenting his loyalties, where obviously he's married to Kathy and Kathy is in love with Benny, but he has his loyalty to his gang. And Johnny sees something in Benny, and Johnny knows that Benny will do whatever Johnny pretty much asks for him. So I'm curious, Alonzo, where did you think of that angle of this film?
Yeah, there's definitely a father-son relationship going on between the two of them. And again, because these are both characters who are presented as people who don't talk about their feelings in a way that, you know, is dramatically convenient for the audience, we have to sort of infer so much of it by their body language and sort of the conversations that they have. There's, you know, in my review, I kind of jokingly said, you know, like for queer artists like Tom of Finland or Kenneth Anger, like the sort of, you know, inherent homoeroticism of bikers, you know, has sort of like led them to different sort of artistic pursuits. This movie, the closest we get to that is there's a scene where Benny and Johnny are practically whispering to each other, and they're sort of moving their heads around each other, and their mouths and their ears are very close together because they're speaking so quietly. And it is one of those moments where it's like, okay, there's a version of this where they kiss, but we're not going to get that. But yeah, I think there is that relationship, you know, is as much of a focus of the film as his actual marriage to Kathy is.
It's interesting. Yeah. You point out that scene. It's like, yes, there's a vibe to it to a point, but it also feels like, is this just like a dare? Like, did Hardy just be like, I'm gonna act this close to you and see what you do? coming
We're
at
playing
me.
Chicken.
Yeah, I'll show you what acting is. And Austin was like, oh, fine, okay, we're doing this game, huh? But Jimmy, same kind of question. I mean, obviously there's, you know, there are, the film tries to explore like what it is that Benny's after, what is it Johnny's after, what's Kathy after. Did you appreciate like having this kind of a focus compared to like, you know, just like a random gangs here, now we gotta fight them or something?
It gives it a beating heart. You know, Jody is the character is such a, I don't know, she's everyone. You know, she seems like someone people can relate to. I liked her. She reminds me of my neighbor, literally. So I think the three characters connecting, and I that scene is absolutely brilliant. The two of them together, it's, I can see both of your points with that. I would see it as a dare, but I also see that kind of the almost romanticized vision of these two men, you know?
The intent is very clear as far as Johnny at that point is like mapping out a succession plan. And it needs like the guy he's decided he can trust the most at all this. Like that, it's a good idea for a scene. I like the scene. It's just, it's staged in a way where it's like, I don't feel like Jeff Nichols, like, this is what the spacing's going to be. That feels like the actor's decisions as far as this is what we're planning to do for this kind of scene.
Might be, yeah.
Just keep up.
I absolutely love it. I love that. So, you know, it's hard because there's really nothing I didn't like about this film. So I'm bashing way too much. But I appreciate your guys is more... less excitable. I think it's a
crowd pleasing movie. I like that about it.
Oh yeah.
If you're gonna make a biker gang movie like this with these movie stars in it, cool. Like I'm down for that.
Yes, right.
It's a movie that feels like it's doing exactly what it's setting out to do. And you know, so, and even if it's taking an unconventional way of getting there, I think that it's still, you leave with a sense of what this was. And I think that's what Nichols is trying to capture, you know. And it's funny because Christy and I did this on Breakfast All Day. She was not a fan, and she sort of talked about, you know, given its source material, that to her, it felt like a photo book that was all images and no text, you know. But I think within the images, there's a lot to glean here, even if it's not coming out of the characters' mouths.
Boom. Mike Feist, by the way, thankless. It's a thankless role, but I like his presence. I like this, hey, Mike Feist.
They say acting is all listening, and that's all.
He's doing a shit ton of acting. Let me tell you. We mentioned Jodie Comer a few times at this point. What do you think of her in this film?
I don't want you riding. Yeah, it scares me, especially this soon after surgery. I don't like it.
You don't like
me. Oh, I get worried.
I should just go. I'm just gonna leave.
What?
No, it's better. You'd be better
off. Stop it.
Not having to take care of me. Worry about me.
No.
When I heal up, I leave.
I think she's great. I love the character. I love what she does with it. I think it's... it feels genuine, and that's a tough thing because that could have easily come off as maybe overly cartoonish. It's got the accent. I think she plays it in such a way that she just feels real. This feels like a real person that you really can connect to. I love that performance, honestly.
Here's what I can say about the accent. It's
okay.
It kept me listening, for one thing.
I saw
this movie with my dad. He's from Baltimore. He's Baltimore. He's from Silver Spring, Maryland. I'll be correct and not just generalize. But he's heard plenty of people from Chicago in his day. That doesn't make him an expert on people from Chicago, but hearing her and Johnny, he was like, "This is how people talk to me. Like this reminded me of Chicagoans." I'm not going to be here saying this is an authentic Chicago, but I no doubt know that she probably listened to tapes of Kathy and has a very idea of what she sounds, very specific idea of what she sounds like. But the thing that matters more than all of that, it is consistent. There is not a point where the accent drops. Right. And that's more important to me than whether or not it's 100% accurate. As long as she's sticking with the thing, same with Tom Hardy for that matter, who loves his accents, they are doing the same accent throughout. It doesn't feel like it's dipping or it's going any other direction.
Right.
And yeah, it added a quirk to the performance in not a negative way. It just made it like, okay, cool. This is the thing that she does. This is the way she says.
It's charming. It's absolutely charming.
Yeah, it's hard to be like the when you're the audience conduit into the world of the film and you're the narrator, essentially. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a lot to take on. I like you. I liked listening to her. I liked seeing where the story's going to go. I think I could see a one-woman show of her just doing this character on stage, sitting on a stool, wearing some, you know, like sleeveless kind of, you know, 1964 housewifey kind of thing, and take out the bikers. And just, I would listen to her tell us the story of all of this, and I would find it compelling.
Kathy tells
you know, that. And it's tricky, I think, for actors when they know they're playing a real person and they have access to what that person sounds like.
Uh-huh.
Do y'all remember a movie from the mid-90s directed by George Miller called Lorenzo's Oil?
Nick Nolte does a very, very specific accent.
Nick Nolte is doing an accent that is like, you know, it's a me Mario. And then you hear the guy that he's doing, it's like, oh, no, he's crushing dead the accent. On.
And again, it's the whole, he is sticking with it. Now let me get close to the camera and like monologue in a monotone voice. He is doing the voice the entire time.
But like, if you are exposed to that voice for the first time as an audience, you're like, oh, what is happening here? Even though they they've done the research and they have like are trying to get it right and nail the thing of the real person, you know. So yeah, I have to give it to her. Like, she's clearly like going after that. There were a couple moments where I found myself thinking of when Tina Fey would do the character from Pittsburgh who would talk about the mummers, you know. But for the most part, I thought, okay, yeah, I believe this woman. I believe the way it's being presented to me, and I'm fascinated. I will not stop listening to her. I think she's fab.
since I started this thing off by seemingly ragging on Austin Butler, I just want to say his whole deal at the beginning of the movie where he waits outside Kathy's house the entire day and just smokes, and like the boyfriend leaves and sees him and he goes and he comes back and he's still there. That's good stuff. That's like, I don't know if that's like a move. I'm sure it probably is, and it's probably creepier. But as far as how this movie presents that, it's like, all right, I'm into this.
They don't have to have a conversation. This is why she falls in love with him. You know, you get it.
Which is fun because like, she is a smart woman. She is a character who clearly has agency, clearly knows what's going on, but she can't resist that Austin Butler just hanging outside her house. And credit to him, like, to be an actor like that, that's choosing to do very little.
Yeah.
That brings us back to like we're that far, but like to like Ryan Gosling when he was doing when he had that period before he became funny, when he was doing more stoicism and was making it work for him. I mean, mm-hmm. Butler's doing something here that I do appreciate as far as how do you call to mind classic stars like Brando or James Dean? And it's like, well, he's got the hair. They're filming in the right way. All right.
I think you know, those are certainly obvious antecedents, but I mean, you could connect this to like silent cinema because so much of him is like holding a close up and about not talking, but just like the camera being, you know, I mean, like they really work the angles of his face in Dune 2, but even here, he is just like radiating so much whatever it is that the camera is picking up that audiences respond to that. Yeah, that, you know, I'm imagining like pages of dialogue being thrown. I was like, nope, just another close up. We're good.
another good, like, as far as like kind of informing you, like how these characters function, where like he's at a point where he's being chased by cops on his motorcycle at one point and he runs out of gas and it's like, well, just gotta wait here for the cops. Like that's fun stuff. Like this movie does like have an idea of like what do you do to like make these motorcycle gangs like make a level of sense, but also seem cool in their own way. Which is, you know, that's the allure of a lot of these kind of like crime dramas, right? They get you close to being like on their side as far as like look at the good times we're having and everything before it like pulls back the curtain. It's like also, you know, these guys bad. I was a bit curious, but like perhaps because this is the end of the golden era, but even then, not a lot of mention of racism, which I'm sure was probably pretty heavy for a group like this, let alone the ones that would come onto the group later on.
Yeah, they definitely, you know, never met a Nazi insignia they didn't feel like sewing onto a jacket or having a picnic on, you know. But, you know, again, I think it's because we're not getting there. This movie isn't really giving you context in terms of meanwhile, you know, like other things happening politically or socially or whatever. It is this vacuum pack sealed off world of these guys and their bikes.
And being from Kathy's perspective, her point isn't to be like, yeah, Johnny and Benny were having a great time. Also, we hated these black guys. Like, that wasn't really, it's not going to be her narrative.
Sure.
It's going to be presenting it like it is. It's this golden age of motorcycle gangs before, because like that's the whole thing, right? We're watching like the end of a certain period of the time for the good old boys and the motorcycle gangs before things got heavy. What else? I
just learned after seeing it that apparently the kid, the aforementioned character who becomes more important as it comes along, is Charles Bronson's grandson.
Okay.
Oh, I'm not surprised. Actually, now that I was like, he looks like somebody to me.
He wasn't super ugly, so it didn't occur to me right away. But I mean,
stop it!
Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot I was talking with the cuties for Bronson fan club over here.
I'm double checking this to see if it's an actual thing or just something somebody told me.
The kid, I said,
no, look, good, yeah.
Wallace.
Yes, there's been a discussion lately about the ugly cute guys or whatever.
Rat face, I believe, is the word.
Thank you.
Yes. Rat face?
Rodent faced with the people like, what's his name, from The Bear and Barry Keoghan. And,
Josh O'Connor.
Yeah, from Challengers. I know that's been, which has to be a weird like group to be a part of.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, it's not saying anything on his wiki page, so maybe he's not Charles Bronson grandson to me.
Maybe not.
He's British born and Australian. So yes. I mean, I'm not saying that makes it impossible, but it certainly limits
anyway.
But looking at him now in his face, I could see it. Like if that was
I bought it when I was told that. It seemed true, but you know. Let's say he is the spiritual grandson of Charles Bronson.
I'm just gonna type the words together and see if that happens. But yeah, I got nothing. Anyway, I know I mentioned Tom Hardy. Did you guys like Tom Hardy in this movie? Are you guys Tom Hardy doing his thing in this movie?
My favorite Tom Hardy performance is Locke. So like I like a Tom Hardy that you can actually understand. But I get the appeal of a Tom Hardy, you know, covering half of his face with a mask, or, you know, playing a bootlegger who's does all of his talking inside of his sinuses. Like, you know, he likes to muck about with that stuff. So I was not surprised to get a mumbly, you know, like truck driver imitating a method actor, you know, a voice in this. And so I just kind of go with it. I'm like, all right, Tom Hardy. And, you know, obviously as a presence, he's always fascinating. And I mean, I think he's a terrific actor. I just, you know, I'm his accent-y stuff is not always my favorite stuff, but it's still good.
Fair.
I'm a Mads fan. He's probably my favorite modern actor. And it's a lot of it. He just chooses roles that I like. I like the work a lot. I mean, Aaron knows my love for Fury Road. It's probably everyone on Twitterverse or whatever they call Xverse knows I'm a big fan. I love Locke. Does he do movies I don't like? Sure. Absolutely. But generally he's interesting.
Yes, we will all see Venom 3. That's, I mean, you know.
Yes. Like... Yes.
And yes, that's largely because it's him in a Venom horse. I mean, who doesn't want to see those things?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to think of what other stones do I turn here about the Bike Riders, but I think we've covered pretty much the movie at this point. Any other final thoughts on the Bike Riders? Then let's go to when people should go and see this movie. Jimmy, when should people see the Bike Riders?
Right damn now. They should see it already.
Alonzo?
I think this is a, I would say see it on the big screen because it is the kind of film that you are more likely to enjoy it if you allow yourself to be immersed in it. I think when you're streaming, it's too easy to have a couple other screens going and the window open and whatever else. And so I think because this movie is operating on such a specific level of sort of, you know, ambience versus, you know, dramatization, to really fully get that ambience, you want to be, you know, in a theater.
I can agree with that for sure. Again, I like the movie. I think it's a good time. I can agree that like if you're looking for something that's like catering to a whole lot of depth, I don't necessarily think that's what this movie's trying to accomplish. But in terms of like presenting you with this world of the outlaw biker gang that we just frankly haven't seen very much in a long time outside of the TV show stuff, this does the job, and it has good movie star looking actors to kind of fulfill the roles that you want for a movie like this. So I think it's a good time.
We were talking earlier about AIP, and you know, in the early 60s they were all about the Poe adaptations, but the late 60s they were making, you know, the Wild Angels and all these other sort of movies leading up to Easy Rider. That's where a lot of those filmmakers, you know, came out of AIP.
And
it's weird though that's like a genre unto itself that's just like the TikTok generation doesn't know about this. I guess like they might have like a passing reference to James Dean or Brando. Even Brando's not like a huge motorcycle guy, but like Easy Rider, like those are things they know the term. But the idea of there's like 70 biker movies produced by Roger Corbett and others, like that's like, I guess that was a thing. Like
I think Gimme Shelter kind of takes the rose off the bud or whatever, you know.
Fair enough. No. All right, well, the Bike Riders is playing now, and we all recommend it. We'll certainly go see it.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, let's move on. Now, let's get this about now feedback. Feedback, feedback, feedback. This is where we go over the various questions and answers on our Facebook page. Facebook.com slash Sentinel Podcast. We asked a number of questions to the listeners, and they gave some answers, and then they gave us some questions that we could answer as well. Jimmy, Alonzo, I'm going to let you guys throw in your answers as well as I go through these. But
okay.
First one we have here, who are your favorite cinematic rebels? Chris Cleland has Luke from Cool Hand Luke and Furiosa. Philip Hurt has General Han Solo.
Todd Leavitt, a friend of the show, has Pee Wee Herman. He's a Rebel Dottie. Mark Hoff, my friend of the show, has Sophia Patella in Rebel Moon. Scott Mendelson, friend of the show, has Kevin from We Need to Talk About Kevin. These answers get sillier as I go on. And Brandon Peters, friend of the show, writes Emperor Palpatine in Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker just might be the ultimate cinematic bad boy. Okay. Stupid. Cinematic Rebels. What do you guys got?
Are we being serious? Are we jokey? I don't know.
I got a lot of the jokes out of my system, apparently, in these last few
I don't second Pee Wee Herman without irony. I think
he's absolutely
an iconoclast. I have a little section of my book where I talk about, like, I think people, especially in the 80s, which was such a conformist period, much like the 50s were, the characters like Pee Wee, Elvira in Elvira, Mistress in the Dark, I think is really, you know, sort of like epateing la bourgeoisie. And then Tracy Turnblad in Hairspray.
Yeah, there you go.
I was always partial to Christian Slater in Heathers.
There you go.
Sure. Yeah.
Perfect example.
There you go.
Or Pump Up the Volume, for that matter.
Pump Up the Volume.
Yeah. Oh, especially Pump Up the Volume. It's a great movie.
All right. Next question we have here. What are your favorite films featuring a biker gang? Mark Hoffmeyer writes, Stone Cold is wonderful. Luke White Thompson, friend of the show, has, I like The Private Club of the Satan's Helpers. I believe that's back in Pee Wee again. Michael Lee, friend of the show, has The Capsules from Akira. Chris Cleveland has Mad Max and Furiosa. And Philip Hurd also has Akira.
Favorite Pee Wee's Big Adventure for sure.
We're all on the Pee Wee.
I mean, Thelma counts, right? No.
The biker gangs.
Yeah, it's kind of got
a couple
gang.
More scooters in there.
Oh yeah, for sure.
All right, next question. What's your favorite Tom Hardy performance? Christopher was. It's unfair to have it be one. He's been in some good movies like Locke and Rock and Rolla, The Revenant. I liked him as Bronson. Bronson's my pick, by the way. Mark Hoffmeyer has. Oof, I will go with Warrior. Bronson and Legend are close behind. Chris Cleveland has too many. Has to be Legend, Close Followers, Warrior, and Peaky Blinders. And Philip has Warrior, closely followed by The Drop.
Huh. Drop, not one of my favorites. But again, that was, I'll tell you, I'm not a great judge of Boston accents, but that one I was sort of like, what? Where is this? I don't know.
Is that Gandolfini in there too? Is that that one?
Maybe, and Matthias Skinnert's, right?
Aren't they
both playing like, you know, it's a what's his face, the Dennis Lehane, right?
Yeah, that's what it is.
I mean, I said, Locke remains my favorite. Mm-hmm. I think that's an extraordinary movie, and I love his performance in it. I was not a big fan of, what was it, that TV show that he did on FX?
Taboo.
Oh, you didn't like it? I like that one.
I wanted to, but man, by week four, I was like, oh, get on with it, y'all.
I'm still waiting for season two.
Fair enough. I know, right?
I said Bronson is my favorite. That's where I go to for Hardy.
I can't. There's too many. There's
This means war. I got it. Yes. I heard you.
Yeah, no, I don't. I'm trying to think if we could do the horror film, a really cheesy horror film. And I can't remember the title. It's driving me crazy. And I reviewed it back in the day. It's like, a Greek monster.
Like a Minotaur or something?
Minotaur.
Okay.
That's the title. He was in Minotaur.
Minotaur, It's called Minotaur.
Yes. He's not fucking bad. Sorry. He's not that bad in that.
Unless we not forget, that Inception. Like, I love how he is sort of playing around with what we think we're going to get from a Tom Hardy character. And he's just deliciously sort of, you know, Faye is putting too fine a point on it, but he's definitely like taking the piss with that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a lot of fun to watch, man.
It's like Leo's already doing a thing. And I like that he, and like Joseph Gordon-Levitt's playing all hard, even though he's, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I like that. Yes. He has this kind of decidedly different attitude about it, where he's like, yeah, there's another Tuesday for me, let's do this, let's go on the thing, have some cheeky jokes and what have you. Next question we have here. What are some great films based around interviews? Michael Lee from the show has Interview with the Vampire, Jackie, and Frost Nixon. Scott Middleton has Frailty. That's a great answer. That's really good. And Chris has The Usual Suspects. Films based around interviews.
Would it be cheating to say My Dinner with Andre?
No. That's it.
Interviews. I'm trying. There's a... I'm spacing on the name of the movie I wanted to mention, the 60 Minutes movie.
The Insider?
Insider. Yeah.
The Insider. That's a really good film.
Oh,
really...
and Late Night with the Devil.
I was thinking Late Night with the Devil. Yeah, we might there you go. For recent examples.
That's an interview, yeah.
Let's see. Last question we asked. What are some great films about riding on the open road? Chris Cleveland has Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Easy Rider, and Mad Max. Philip Hurd has Until the End of the World.
Yes, for sure. Gregor Rocky's The Living End.
Yep, right. You could also, Doom Generation was pretty great.
Yes.
Criterion's bringing them all out. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Not Living End, but yeah, the Teen Apocalypse trilogy.
I Fury Road is obviously.
Oh, of course.
All the Mad Max books.
Lost in America.
Lost in America.
Yes. That movie's amazing. Oh my, Julie Haggerty was so good at Albert Brooks.
In terms of like cheering me up scenes, I'll put on Brooks and Gary Marshall in Vegas. That's just an easy, like, if I need 3 minutes. 3 minutes to like make me happy, I can put that scene on.
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
It'll do the job.
So good.
All right, now we got a question here. This one's from Mark Hoffmeyer, friend of the show. He writes, what's your favorite Jeff Nichols film? Pretty straightforward question.
Mud.
Mud fan? Jimmy?
I don't know. You know, I might be Bike Riders. If I'm being real with you, it might be Bike Riders. I really love this flick. I'm telling you, just with me.
As I mentioned, I'm a big Jeff Nichols fan as well. Take Shelter is my answer to that question. That said, Sony just released Shotgun Stories, his first film, on Blu-ray for the first time this week.
And great.
I rewatched it before this weekend because I wanted to. I hadn't seen it in a while. That's just a really good debut. Like, you can see why critics latched on to him as quickly as they did. It's a very strong debut. And a very good Boys Will Be Boys type movie. If you want to see something along the lines of Bike Riders, but made with like a minimal budget, the Shotgun Stories is a really good example of that. And Michael Shannon, he's great in it, as one would expect.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's our feedback. And with that, Jimmy, I believe you're going to depart us now at this point. But before you go,
yes,
where can people find more of you online?
Of course, you can find me at, of course, always at Jimmy O. Joe, at Joe Blow. I'm there. You can find me on X. You know, whatever they call it, Jimmy to the O, usually not the number, just the T-O. Mm-hmm. I think that's still on Instagram, all that. That's about it. That's it right for now. But I'm not on social media that much lately, so.
Fair enough.
We expect much.
Well, Jimmy, as always, it's been great talking to you. I look forward to having you back on the show soon enough.
Same.
For sure. But yeah, you...
Great time talking about this movie. Go see this movie, guys.
All right. Well, have a good one, Jimmy.
Thanks, Chris.
All right.
Take care.
Okay. So now we're going to move into our next segment here, which is going to be fun because we're going to do a little interview. We're going to talk about Alonzo Duralde's book, Hollywood Pride. So before I ask my hard-hitting questions that I have laid out here, I just want to get a brief description. What is this book all about?
Sure. Well, it basically, you know, kind of trying to throw my arms around the queer history of American cinema, both in terms of how have LGBTQ+ stories and characters been presented on the screen, but then also trying to put a spotlight on the many LGBTQ+ artists who kind of shaped the cinema over the last, 130 years, and certainly, worked on, films that continue to resonate. I've said that, like, obviously a lot of the great queer films are made by queer filmmakers, but queer filmmakers also made a lot of the movies your dad likes.
Fair enough. It's good. Well, you very kindly sent Abe and I a copy of your book, and I've read the whole book at this point.
I appreciate it.
Very enjoyable read. And it's presented in such a way that I really appreciate, where you have various chapters devoted to different, I don't want to say decades, but certainly different periods of time. Mm-hmm. And then within each chapter, you have like a list of different films. You have the different icons of the era, what have you. So it's divided up very nicely in a way that people that like film history and like to absorb it the way I like to, which is, I think, a lot of people that listen to this kind of podcast, can very easily kind of get an idea of the history.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
LGBTQ plus representation in film. I'll say this right off the bat. The queer community, they haven't always had it easy. I don't know if you noticed. I don't know if you noticed that.
Still don't in a great many ways. In telling the story, you know, I didn't know this going in, but, you know, around the time that you get the famous Dixon experimental sound film, which, if you've seen the movie The Celluloid Closet, it sort of, you know, mm-hmm. bookends the film, but it's this early attempt by the Edison Laboratory to sync up sound and picture. And it's an image of one man is playing the violin and two other men are dancing together. And, you know, they were probably straight. And it was just one of those, like, you know, the way that, you know, gold miners would dance together, you know, because there were no women around, whatever. But nonetheless, it is this image of two men dancing. So it has, you know, I think it counts as sort of the first queer film in a lot of ways. And then right around the time that film is being produced, you have the Oscar Wilde verdict being handed down in England, where he's going to jail for gross indecency. And so it feels like the cinema was born in this moment where society was very much clamping down on the idea of heteronormativity, and anybody who isn't going to run with that, you know, we're going to run you out of town on a rail. And so that's always sort of been there as far as long as this medium has existed, even though going back to the very beginning, you have gay actors and gay writers and gay directors like creating this medium from nothing, you know, and continuing to do so, you know, over the next century plus.
I'm curious, because obviously you had to do a lot of research, I'd imagine, for a work like this. What era did you learn the most about during this process?
Oh, man. I mean, around every corner, I was discovering stuff I didn't know, you know, because the book was pitched to me, like the TCM and Running Press wanted to do it. And I was like, yes, great. I would love to. And I put together a proposal and I thought, oh, yeah, I know this history. I know who these people are. And I constantly encountering stuff I didn't know. So I didn't really know about, you know, like J. Warren Kerrigan, who is this huge, huge movie star in like the 19-teens in very early silent cinema, you know, and all the press coverage him is about like, oh, he and his mother were so close, you know, and he, you know, he had a male partner, but, you know, they was very discreet and you didn't talk about it. And the press certainly never talked about it. You know, I learned that in the 30s, when the production code came into effect, that it not only affected, you know, how movies were made and what stories could be told on screen, but it sort of applied off screen as well, where the studios were basically telling their stars, look, you're going to settle down, you're going to get married. You know, if you're a gay man, you're going to marry a woman. If you're a lesbian, you're going to marry a guy, and we're going to present
your
Hollywood
image. Yeah.
Yeah, so Hollywood is going to be very cozy and homey and family, you know, because I think in the 20s, certainly there had been this notion of like, ooh, Sodom by the Sea and, you know, wild orgies and whatnot. And so yeah, the code not only dictated how films got made, but sort of how Hollywood was presenting itself to the world. So yeah, just all along the way was just things that I didn't know about. And it was exciting to revisit sort of moments I do remember, you know, like when the new queer cinema starts happening in the early 90s, I was working at film festivals then. And so I screened those films and I met those filmmakers at the time, you know, and then in the early 2000s, I was an editor at The Advocate. So obviously I had that perch to be observing like the entire Brokeback Mountain phenomenon from, you know, it's going into production to, you know, it's Oscar night, you know. So yeah, it was a mix of just stuff I didn't know and then just going deeper into things that I did know about.
So I guess that I have a question there. I don't want to make an assumption that saying post Brokeback Mountain would be like where the biggest time of change would be. But I'm curious, was there a time in making this and looking at all the research and everything that you saw the most, like an area where change most occurred as far as like an evolution and how involved or how prominent?
I think it's the 90s. The 90s are a real big boom here, because you have to remember the 80s, the AIDS pandemic happens. Mm-hmm. And if you were like maybe inching your way out of the closet in Hollywood, you were like running back in and bolting the door, because, you know, whether or not, you know, there was a moment there where maybe like they were getting a little more open minded about sort of queerness in general. But once AIDS happens, it's like if people think that you are gay, they're also going to think that you have this disease that they don't understand exactly how it gets transmitted. And so they're not going to hire you, you know, and so there's a real just clamping down on everything. So in 1991, when Poison and Paris is Burning win the Sundance Film Festival, and in a matter of a couple of years, you're getting like Greg Araki and Gus Van Sant and, you know, Go Fish and the Watermelon Woman, sure, and all these other, yeah, all of these films are happening. It is a direct response to a very conservative period of American history, the entire 80s and the first part of the 90s. It's Reagan and Bush. And so I think the 90s is such a pushback to that and such a response to that, that you get to this place where, you know, indie films are embracing romantic comedies about same-sex couples, you know, so movies like Jeffrey or, you know, Trick are opening wider and getting big kind of glossy pushes. Paramount makes, you know, In and Out during this period, you know, so like there's definitely a complete sea change. And so I think, yeah, there's always moments of things happening and stuff being exciting and new innovations. But for me, I think as far as mainstream, you know, like commercial cinema goes, the 90s is a real game changer.
To step things back in time. Now, reading the book, obviously, like, I'm more of that era, the 90s, sure, and onward. So, like, I'm not going to say I was familiar with everything and I learned nothing at that point. But obviously, I had more of a genuine interest book-wise.
Things start ringing a bell.
Yes. I had more of an interest book-wise to see like how you would approach the various things from the golden era, the golden age of Hollywood, and the classic eras or what have you.
Sure. It's a TCM book, so I couldn't.
For sure. Yeah, that makes sense too. So a few things I wanted to point out that both I liked and that is what a question on. One, the hardest laugh I had in this book was when you mentioned Vincente Minnelli, Judy Garland, and Liza Minnelli bringing some kind of queer bingo. That made me laugh. that was good. But one thing I really appreciated was Hitchcock obviously has a way of using queer-coded characters in his films. And I like that instead of, I mean, you have some sections that kind of spotlight a specific film of his, but for the most part, you have this kind of running bit of just saying Hitchcock in the 40s. Hitchcock is like, he was such a given as far as he's going to incorporate this in some way. What was it like during this period of time? I found that kind of approach neat.
Yeah, because I think he's really kind of stands alone in terms of mainstream Hollywood studio filmmakers really playing around with this material and sort of goading the censors to come after him. Mm-hmm. And so you get this mix of things where, yes, on the one hand, you've got like Mrs. Danvers and Rebecca, who is this monstrous character who is clearly obsessed with, you know, this dead woman, you know, fondling her furs and her lingerie. Mm-hmm. But then you get like, you know, the mystery writer in Spellbound who has a female partner and they are, you know, not villainous in any way, you know, but then you also get him very intentionally casting like Ivor Novello or Farley Granger or, you know, most famously, you know, Anthony Perkins in Psycho, where it's like, I know you're closeted. You're going to bring that energy of having a secret, hiding a thing to this character that you're playing on film. And whether or not the movie ever acknowledges it overtly, I know who you are. And I know that you're going to make that work in this portrayal. And certainly in the case of Perkins, it worked so well that it kind of derails the rest of his career in a way, because he becomes so identified with Norman Bates, and because he's revealing a side of himself that audiences hadn't seen before. And it's hard to shake.
With Perkins, it's interesting for me because I grew up with Psycho, and I didn't, I was like, you know, I know he's an actor, he probably worked other roles, but like for the longest time, I did just know him as Norman Bates. I was like more heavily researching and going back and just watching movies for pleasure. So like seeing Anthony Perkins in the kind of post 1960 films that he's popped up in, a lot of Westerns and things, it's like, okay, he is I never thought he was a bad actor. It was like, he is a rangy actor. He has a lot of interesting roles that he's played before he became synonymous with this very specific thing.
Yeah, that role, I think, really came to sort of, you know, maybe not haunt, but I think to dominate, you know, how we've thought about it. But like you go back and watch him in like Tall Story, which is this just goofy, innocuous rom-com with young Jane Fonda. And like, they're really charming together. And he, you know, he was a teen idol. He was a, you know, he released pop singles, you know, but then Psycho happens, you know.
But at least he still got to write the last Sheila with Sondheim.
That's right.
That's wonderful. That's a movie I recently caught up with like a couple years ago at this point. I think around the time Glass Onion was coming out.
Oh,
yeah. Like, let me finally watch this movie Ryan Johnson talks about all the time. I think WB, like WB Archive, I think just like released it or something too, like on Blu-ray.
Yes, they finally put a Blu-ray out.
Let's see what else. I'm a big horror fan. That's a big thing for our movie show. And so I was curious to see like how, because that's a genre where you can do a lot of things as far as presenting coded ideas or subtext or themes or what have you. And so I was certainly curious how you're going to approach areas like that when it came to like the universal horror films or what have you. And like, I gotta say, a little sporadic. Like, I'm not saying this need to have more horror films in it, but I was curious. Like, I knew like James Whale would come up obviously in the actors he worked with, and Bride of Frankenstein I thought would come up more often. But I'm curious how much.
Well, I mean, I look, the first picture you see in the 30s section is James Whale on the set of Frankenstein. So get off my back. Yeah. No, I know that, you know, I had 95,000 words to cover 130 years of cinema, you know, mostly American. I did include some foreign films that played in the States and that had, you know, resonance and importance, you know, with queer audiences. But I mean, even then, like there's a lot I couldn't get to or could only get to sort of, you know, in passing. So, you know, I talk about James Whale quite a bit. I talk about like the lesbian vampire moment of the, you know, of the 1960s. You know, I believe me, if I'd had the space, I could have done a whole thing about Butcher Baker Nightmare Maker, you know, which I think is a fascinating film, like
the,
you know.
Like The Haunting, I know, is another one that would have had a...
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, so I tried to, a lot of them get sort of listed in the, hey, you should also see this, but I just didn't have the real estate to really go in deep. But I was fortunate enough to participate in the Queer for Fear documentary on Shudder, which I would highly recommend to anybody who is interested in the intersection between the world of LGBTQ plus culture and horror, because they really get into it, starting with like, you know, the works of, you know, Bram Stoker and Mary Shelley and Oscar Wilde, and then sort of moving into early cinema. I mean, I talk about Murnau now, obviously, and, you know, his, you know, between Nosferatu and Der Janoskopf, you know, he's sort of laying a lot of groundwork there, and then Whale. And, so yeah, I apologize to everyone for not having. There's so many side avenues that I could have gone into, and I wish I could have, but I just had to kind of, you know, had to keep going.
Certainly mildly kidding on this, but that does lead to my other question, which is, what were the hardest choices you had to make in terms of choosing which films to spotlight?
Yeah, I mean, I had a draft that was way too long, and I had to just kind of go through and just start cleaving. You know, there are definitely some working filmmakers that I had sort of written essays about that had to go. And it's kind of like, well, I mean, you know, you're still out there and your career is still a work in progress, so I guess it's okay. Those were some of the trickiest ones, I think. And, you know, obviously you're so much of cinema history in terms of especially studio cinema history. You don't start seeing a lot of women or people of color or, you know, in this case, trans, you know, filmmakers until you get to the more recent decades. So obviously they're getting priority when I do get to the 21st century. It's like, okay, let's, you know, if I have to choose between, you know, writing about like Sidney Freeland and Elliot Page and, you know, Laverne Cox, or talking about like other filmmakers who I think are really good, but who are, you know, white guys whose careers are still, you
what's
know,
Gus unfolding. Van Sant's up to now? Like,
yeah,
he did get him early on.
I got him back in the 80s. Yeah. But so when, you know, with choices like that, it's kind of like, sorry, white guy who still has a career, but I, you know, we got to go here now.
And that is something I found interesting about the book. It's intentional by default, but like at the end of each chapter, you have just like, yeah, like you mentioned before, the kind of like, what else was out at this time? And you can tell compared to like the 30s,
when you get to the aughts and the ten, like there's a lot more pages at that point.
Absolutely.
Which is encouraging, obviously, for various reasons.
Yeah. I mean, like, in as much as, you know, and I say this in the forward, like, once we get to 1990, if I missed your favorite movie or, you know, filmmaker, sorry, but like there's way too many now, and that's great, and that obviously shows that we've reached a new pinnacle in terms of, you know, there being this, you know, quantity of artists and of material. Mm-hmm. But I tried my best to schmooze in as much as I could.
Fair. Let's see, what else did I want to point out? Oh, well, you had Raymond Barros mentioned. So it's obviously my mind was like, oh, Godzilla's going to, and sure enough, it was. So I'm very happy about that, just by default, because that's the kind of person I am. So
of course.
If I have a reason to point out Godzilla, I will. but Burr, that's why I was like, my mind is not saying it right. Raymond Burr.
Raymond Burr, yes.
But no, I did those icon sections. I did find to be interesting, but largely because I know a thing about a thing, so I have my fair share of knowledge when it comes to a lot of like past movie stars or what have you, people like Rock Hudson or what have you. But like,
sure,
seeing these sections devoted to their lives in different ways, I found that to be interesting. It's interesting to like to read like the kind of not the lengths they would be going, but like you know, having an extra dimension on who they were. And I'm curious what I already mentioned, like what the structure of this book was. Was that something you had in mind of like how to do this kind of thing, or?
One of the things in the structure was I definitely tried at the beginning of each chapter to sort of give a larger context of, sure, like what's happening in the world right now, because films very often are sort of trailing behind, you know, what's really unfolding. And in the case of talking about LGBTQ+ people of the past, you have to remember that there were all these structures in place, whether it was employment related or the law or the church or whatever, that was sort of forcing them to go underground and to, you know, be secretive and quiet about who they were. And so trying to put those stories together later, I think, generally speaking, you know, queer historians find this. You find yourself having to sort of rely upon like gossip, for lack of a better word, you know, for you know, those sort of oral record of people who were around and could talk about, you know, their relationships or their friendships, or, oh yeah, so-and-so used to hang out with whoever, you know. And so it's not the kind of thing where you can find like birth certificates and land records, you know, to give you the information. So, but I do think it's also very important to point out who these folks are, because there is always this concerted effort to erase the accomplishments of queer people and to sort of pretend that, you know, oh, it's this new thing and we just propped out of nowhere and we've never really contributed anything to society and we're nothing but this menace that's out to, like, you know, destroy your life and steal your children or whatever. And it's like, no, we've always been here, and guess what? We've always been in Hollywood, and we've always been making these movies. And in the case of people like Murnau and James Whale, like, there's no cinema without us. Like, these are, you know, fundamental cornerstone architects of the media.
It makes
Dorothy Arzner, you know.
It makes me think of Westerns and the lack of black cowboys in them. And then I certainly, you know, then only in fairly recent times are there more movies that are kind of focused on showing the West for what it was. When just recently now with like the Bass Reeves stuff that's kind of coming out,
yes,
becoming more popular. Or I can go back to just last year, we talked about the film Posse from Mario Van Peebles in honor of its 30th anniversary for 1993. And it's like, there's so much prevalence of certain kinds of things that, yes, get buried because who writes the history books and what we want to emphasize or what have you.
Exactly. And what's cool about this book is that it's sort of part of a series unofficially, I think, that TCM has been putting out. So you had, you know, Donald Bogle's Hollywood Black a few years ago. That was followed by Luis Reyes's Viva Hollywood, which is the Hispanic Latina version of this. And so, you know, I think these books are doing a really good job of being like, you know, cinema and you know some of these figures, but maybe you don't know these other figures, or you don't know these other movies, or you don't know the importance that these, you know, these not white or not straight artists have had, you know, in cinema history. So I'm glad they exist. And I hope that, you know, that people are learning more and understanding more about the many different communities that came together to make Hollywood Hollywood.
Well, as a history graduate, I do just like absorbing knowledge in this kind of way, certainly when it comes to film history, where I've, you know, put so much of my efforts sure. in the past few decades. It's really neat just to learn different aspects of different areas of, you know, the century plus long time that we've had to spend with film at this point. Alonzo, thank you very much for talking to me about your book.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
It's available in all stores now, right? And online, yes, on Amazon and all that. Anywhere you can find books.
Yes, exactly. Including your local library. It's a book. It's an ebook and an audio book. So whichever you care to enjoy, please do.
Did you do the audio or something?
I did the audio.
You did the audio. Oh, my God. And I read it like a sucker. I could
have. Oh, you know, it is a gorgeous piece of work. Like, I had nothing to do with it. The layout, the photos, the design is really beautiful. I'm so proud of how this thing looks just as an object. And then, you know, the text is nice too.
Very cool. Well, once again, thank you very much for talking with me about your book. With that said, that's going to do it for this week's episode of Out Now, Third and Ape. You can find out everything I do at my personal Substack page, thecodazeek.substack.com. I am the editor-in-chief over at We Live Entertainment. All my movie reviews can be found there. I write Blu-ray and Criterion reviews over at Why So Blue, and I'm on all the socials at Aaron's PS4. Alonzo Duralde, where can people find more of you online?
Oh, golly. Let's see. Well, I'm the film critic at thefilmverdict.com, so you can read my reviews of new movies there. I'm on a ridiculous amount of podcasts, including Linoleum Knife, which you mentioned, which my husband Dave White and I have been doing since 2010. I'm on Maximum Film on the Maximum Fun Network. I do a show called Breakfast All Day with Christy Lemire that you can catch on YouTube or as a podcast. I pop in regularly at Deck the Hallmark to talk about usually non-Hallmark Christmas movies. My latest podcast that is just dropping now is The Film Library, a Canopy podcast, in which Daniel Thompson and I have been talking to filmmakers and critics about different kinds of different, you know, just categories of cinema, but also about the many amazing films that you can see on Canopy for free with a library card. Our guests for season one, which is in the process of coming out now, include Patton Oswalt, Justin Simien, Cheryl Dunier, Kristen Lopez, Francis Lee, Alex Winter, and recent Pulitzer Prize winner Justin Chang.
Well, there you go. Yeah, Abe and I are big fans of Canopy. We recommend it all the time because it's our favorite streaming service. Honestly,
it's so great.
I'm watching Victory right now on Canopy. I've never seen the Stallone Kane Pele classic before. Classic is what
John Huston,
it.
Baby.
John Huston's one of his final films. Yeah. It is certainly a movie that they filmed with cameras, as I've watched it so far. but no, we're big fans of Canopy, and that's very cool. There's a podcast devoted around Canopy. So
thank you
on that. You can find all the other episodes about Now 30 Abe on iTunes, Audioboom, Spotify, and Stitcher. Feel free to follow us on all the socials, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We're all some form of /outnow_podcast. You can email us at outnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, as iTunes reviews and ratings do to get those, helps out the show. And yes, next week we're going to talk. What are we talking about next week? What is it? A Quiet Place, of course. Day One. That'll be our show for next week. And of course, there's plenty of movies coming out around that time, so we might have some extra bonus stuff coming your way, just like we've had for the past few weeks. But with all that said, Alonzo, thank you very much for joining me today.
My pleasure. It's always a good time talking.
And thanks once again to Jimmy O for joining us as well for our review of The Bike Riders. Thank you, the listeners, for listening. And that's going to do it for this week. So until next time, so long, and good time. I wanna holler, but the town's too small.